12-17. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Senator Stump, I believe Senator Kelash moved that Senate File 12-17 be recommended to pass and be referred to the general orders.
Okay.
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, this is a bill requested by Marshall County commissioners. And Marshall County, if you remember a number of weeks ago, I had a proposal identical to this for Kitson County. And Kitson County is way up in the northwest corner of the borders, Manitoba and North Dakota. Well, Marshall County is right underneath Kitson County. So I think what happened, I think at that time I also mentioned that Marshall County was interested in the same kind of legislation. And I don't have all of the specifics as I did for Kitson County, but I do know in talking to the county auditor and the some of the board members that they would like to have this legislation available for them too. And it doesn't remove any of the statutory responsibilities. It does the elected recorder and county auditor and treasurer have to serve out their existing terms. And then the board would, if this passed, the board would then be able to make those, the county recorder and auditor and treasurer appointed positions. And so basically this is identical, well, it is identical to the Kitson County request.
Okay, thank you. Does anyone else in the audience care to testify on Senate File 12-17? Any questions from members? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember back when I was in the House that we had an issue with appointed officers, which I support appointing officers, and I thought we maybe made it statewide, but obviously we didn't. There was no provision that gives the local units of government the option to make it appointed at their discretion. Obviously that didn't happen.
Mr. Chairman and Senator McGuire, no, it has to be
adopted,
county specific. So it's, that's why you do have, and I believe I think it's about 20. Senator Roebling might know this. 20 or 20 some counties, I believe, that have some variation of the this.
Senator Roebling.
Sure. Senator Stump, I think it's closer to 30.
30.
There's
no.
been a lot of them in my time here, a couple a year, and so it's very common now.
And I supported it.
Thank you.
Okay. Additional further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Kelash renews his motion that Senate File 12-17 be recommended to pass and placed on general orders. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails and the bill is passed and be referred to general orders.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Okay, next bill is Senator Roebling, Senate File 1157. And now the chair will take 1157 off the table. Whatever. We're doing it. Okay, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As you may recall, we were here last week talking about this bill, which would change the Transportation Advisory Board to the Metropolitan Transportation Board. It would change the composition of the board so that the members who are not elected, the citizen members who are appointed, would be changed, and we would have a much larger composition of elected officials on that board. believing in the spirit of the federal law, that was really the intent. Although we do know now that the Federal Transportation Administration has said that they do accept the way our board is currently comprised, we would like to continue to look at this matter and see if there is a better way to put together this board, which we don't believe should be really advisory. They should be the ones that really make the decisions on how the federal funds, the grants from the federal government, are directed, and they should be the decision makers. And so we have the proposal before us. I know we had quite a bit of a discussion on it last Monday. So it was quite a while ago. And we can talk about it some more today. The intention right now is I would like to get it moved to the Transportation Committee. It has been tabled in the House in the Transportation Committee, and the author there is not intending to take it up anymore this session. And so we do want to continue to get this one parked in the same committee and continue to have discussion around that whole issue of how this should be governed, because we truly believe that there needs to be some changes made. We think that over the summer, over the interim, we maybe need to bring together the former Commission on Metropolitan Governance, which has been quite inactive, but they are still in statute. The composition of that commission is still outlined in statute and could be resurrected, so to speak, and reactivated to talk more about this. And certainly part of the impetus for this is the report from the legislative auditor on transit governance and the recommendations that changes should be made, because it has hampered the way the systems have been developing. And so we think this is an important issue, an issue that needs to have continued discussion, and we want to move it a little bit but continue to work on it as we look at it throughout the interim and bring it back for the second half of the biennium.
Thank you. And there are other testifiers?
They're here to answer questions, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Ulrich did testify last week, and Lisa Fries from the Scott County Transportation Division is here in case there's any technical questions.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd care to testify for or against Senate File 1217? Or 1157. Any questions from the members? Further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Roebling renews her motion that Senate File 1157, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Transportation. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Senator Daley.
You skipped me?
Okay, Senator, how about 1225? Would you like to stay up there? Pick up Senate File 1225, Senator Roebling. Senator Roebling moves Senate File 1225 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Senator Roebling, to your bill.
Thank you, members. We do have a bill here that is sort of a cleanup bill for the Campaign Finance Board. And this is always an issue that interests legislators a lot because it affects us directly and how we file and when we need to file with the Campaign Finance Board, and at what point in the dollar amount that new committees have to file. And we also have an issue that is related to the independent expenditures and the development with the new rules that corporations can now have involvement in political campaigns. And so I have with me today Gary Goldsmith from the Campaign Finance Board. He's the executive director there. And he would like to go over the provisions of the bill. It is rather lengthy, but it actually covers just several major areas. And he would like to explain those for us.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Rather than go through the bill section by section, I think I would like to start by just outlining the topics that the bill covers and the things that the bill attempts to accomplish. Excuse me. And this bill does reflect the Campaign Finance Board's official recommendations for this legislative session. We aim to do a couple of things in this bill. First of all, to simplify some of the requirements of Chapter 10A to make it easier to comply with. And secondly, to provide some ability for the board to provide better customer service to those people who are regulated by Chapter 10A. In doing these things, we also are looking at opportunities to improve the constitutional standing of the whole chapter and of our campaign finance disclosure system. As members are probably aware, the U.S. Supreme Court is taking a closer look at campaign finance regulation and in some cases overturning what people believe to be law that was going to hold for a long time. So we're following those things and making recommendations as we believe they're appropriate. So one of the big changes that this bill would accomplish is to increase registration thresholds for all types of filers in the campaign finance program. This is of interest in the federal courts right now. The highest it's reached is in Colorado, where a $250 threshold for registration of a local ballot question committee was held to be too low to be constitutional. What the court does is looks at the burden of having to register and report compared to the amount of money that's being spent and determines whether that burden is too high. And they said for a local school board ballot question, that making them register at $250 of spending was too low, was too much of a burden. Minnesota's threshold is $100. So the changes we're recommending are, first of all, for principal campaign committees of candidates and all regular party units and political committees and funds, the registration threshold would raise from $100 to $250. For candidates, this would eliminate some candidates who spend a little bit of money trying to get the nomination at the convention, don't get the nomination and don't go forward. Having spent $100, they are required to register and report. At least this would let them spend up to $250 before they get into the system. For ballot question committees and independent expenditure committees, these are the groups that only make ballot question expenditures or only make independent expenditures. They don't make donations directly to candidates. As a result, they can use corporate money. In that situation, the courts have held that the only government interest that we can support through disclosure is letting people know who's doing the speaking that's trying to influence them. There's no question of undue influence of an official because there are no officials involved in ballot questions or independent expenditures. For those committees, we're recommending that the threshold be raised from $100 to $1,000. We know that the Colorado Court of Appeals at the federal level has said $250 is too low. We think that $1,000 may be high enough to be constitutional. It's an open question yet in federal law, but we think at least that this would take the target off of Minnesota as the next defendant in a lawsuit alleging that our thresholds for registration are too low. So in other words, these changes keep some of the lower spending individuals, associations, and corporations out of the campaign finance system. As a result, it's less burdensome on them, and it strengthens the constitutionality of our overall system. Another change that we're proposing that would allow the board to provide better service to its constituents and, again, make things easier for filers is for the board to assume limited jurisdiction over three provisions in Chapter 211B. Chapter 211B is not under the board's jurisdiction. It's the Fair Campaign Practices Act. And a lot of it deals with things like false advertising and using the term re-elect and things like that. The board does not seek and does not want jurisdiction over those types of provisions. However, three provisions overlap the board's jurisdiction and relate largely to financial disclosure. The first of those is the provision relating to corporate spending. The board now has jurisdiction over independent expenditures because in 2010 the legislature unanimously passed legislation providing us with jurisdiction to obtain disclosure from those entities. Corporations are still prohibited from making direct contributions to candidates, and that's in 211B, which the board does not have jurisdiction over. We continually get questions about the application of that provision. And because there's no other agency that has the authority to answer those questions, we do it. We answer them, even though we have to, at the end, say, but you should seek your own legal advice, because our advice is not authoritative. One of the most common questions was, what do I have to do to put a sign on corporate property and avoid having a prohibited contribution occur in that transaction? And we try to help with that, but again, we didn't have the authority to do it from a legal standpoint. We try not to just turn callers away with no place for them to turn. Another provision is the provision of 211B that generally regulates how you can use campaign money. And the board has jurisdiction over non-campaign disbursements, but not over general spending of campaign money. And so when we investigate cases where it looks like there might be improper use of campaign money, we can't get at the crux of the matter because it's not under our jurisdiction. We have had at least two cases recently based on filed complaints where it appeared that money was used inappropriately, and the board had to investigate those based on a false filing of a report because we couldn't get at the basis of the actual violation. And in fact, the filers had not reported this misuse of money, and so the board found that kind of violation. Again, we get questions all the time about this provision, and we try to provide guidance, but then we recommend that they talk to the party unit or their own legal counsel. And finally, Chapter 211B includes the prepared and paid for disclaimer provision. The board has jurisdiction over the independent expenditure disclaimer, but not over the prepared and paid for disclaimer. And again, we get questions about how do you combine the two? Do I have to have a disclaimer on a button? How do I do a disclaimer on a small web banner ad that points to some other page where the disclaimer is there? And again, we suggest that to be able to answer those questions and thus provide service to the committees who we regulate, we ought to have jurisdiction over those provisions. I have provided this bill to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the Minnesota Business Partnership. I've had positive feedback from both. Nobody has told me that there's anything in the bill that they object to. And in fact, parts of these additional jurisdictions have been in the Chamber's recommendations in previous years. The third thing, as Senator Roebling mentioned, is we deal with ballot question expenditures. Again, corporations can participate in spending on ballot questions. But Chapter 10A doesn't have a clear description of what kind of disclosure should be required in that circumstance. Last year, the legislature adopted a system of disclosure for corporations engaged in independent expenditures. This bill would simply extend that same system to corporations engaged in ballot question expenditures. There are some things that are designed to make it easier and avoid unintentional violations. I'll just mention a couple. A candidate who runs for office and loses in the primary still has to file a pre-general election report. Usually they think they don't have to because they lost the primary and they don't file it often. This bill would remove that requirement. Likewise, those candidates are supposed to file notices of large contributions received before the general election, even though they're not in the general election. This bill would remove that requirement as well. One new thing is that the board is seeking some authority to help it provide a new type of electronic form. Under Chapter 10A, the board is required to provide forms for filing of all types, and we do that. Electronic filing is going to be mandatory in the campaign finance program next year, and the board is intending to provide a range of options to enable treasurers to file electronically. There is also a waiver provision so that if there's a good reason why they don't want to or can't, they would not have to. But we already have our campaign finance software. That's a good product for mid-size committees to use, and many, many do, especially newer committees. We have a high percentage of new filers or new registrants using that. We're also working with vendors to provide so that they can provide their their commercial products to governors' committees and party units. We have a fairly large group, though, of small committees who we think it would be probably a little bit too much for them to learn the campaign finance software because they really don't have a lot of transactions, and yet we'd like them to be able to file electronically. What we would like to do to make it simplest for the treasurers is to provide essentially an electronic form. For that to be simple, it needs to be web-based, and it needs to be hosted by the board. Otherwise, you get involved with installing software and things like that, users maintaining the software. The problem with that is that we'd like a form where the treasurer can come in and work on the form from time to time, get it up to date, and then when it's ready, click the button that says file this data. If we were to do that now, under the Data Practices Act, every time the treasurer entered data on that form that was stored in an encrypted, secure server maintained by the board, technically that would be public data, and we would have to release it to anybody who asked for it. Obviously, that data shouldn't be public until the treasurer says, this is my report, and I file it. So there is a provision in the bill that would allow us to maintain that sort of system, and the data would not be public data until that report was filed by the treasurer. The board wouldn't have access to it either, and that's why this bill will be going to Senator Limmer's committee. Then there are a couple of technical corrections and cleanup language that I'll be happy to answer questions about if members have questions.
Mr. Goldsmith, how many, with regard to the electronic filing, how many people currently, or would you say, over the last year, filed manually still?
Senator Van Veer, I don't have that number here, but I can tell you a couple things about it. The percentage of candidates filing electronically is much higher than the percentage of political committees, funds, and party units. And the percentage of candidates who have registered since about 2002 is much higher than the percentage of candidates who have registered prior to that. So certainly well over 50% of the newer candidates are using the software and filing electronically now. And that number drops off as we get to candidates who have been in the system for years and years. Part of the reason for that, we know, is that treasurers have been with those candidates for many years and have their own systems and maybe don't even use computers, and they would, of course, be subject to getting a waiver.
So, Mr. Goldsmith, who would have to file electronically next year if under this bill?
Mr. Chair, this bill does not affect who would have to file electronically. That was passed in 2009 by the Senate and in 2010 by the House and through conference committee. So that's 2010 legislation, effective for 2012. And it would require everyone to file electronically, but it does mandate that the board must grant a waiver if the filer has good cause. And good cause includes things like not using a computer, not having internet access, being too small to merit using some sort of electronic system. We are developing those standards now and we'll be contacting the non-electronic filers yet this year to determine how many will be looking for waivers. We'll also be going out into the field this year to do additional training around the state as opposed to in St. Paul where we've done it before.
Mr. Goldberg, it does seem like if half of the new people are filing electronically, that means half or more than half are not currently doing that, and it could seem like that 2012 date could be something maybe we should look at.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the board's preference is that the board would look at being more liberal in granting waivers during the first election cycle, the 2012 election cycle. It's not the board's intention it's the board's desire to have electronic filing. But the board realizes that this is going to take some time, and I think we would expect to be liberal in granting those waivers during this next cycle and tighten things up as they go. As I've said, we are gradually increasing the numbers anyway, and it's our preference to do that through the gradual use rather than by forcing people to. So I prefer not to see the bill change. And that wouldn't be this bill. That would be the existing statute.
Okay. Additional questions? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. You mentioned the disclaimer rule, and I'm just having a hard time finding it in the bill where that disclaimer language is, because I just wanted to look at it one more time. And then also, if you could just review again what the repeal repealer language does. Oh,
yes, I meant to do that, and I will certainly do that. But the disclaimer is actually in 211B, and it says that you have to put a disclaimer that says prepared and paid for by the committee. The way the board would be obtaining that jurisdiction is in section, let me just turn to it here. Section 5 of the bill, the board already has authority to investigate violations of Chapter 10A, and then it says the board may also investigate alleged violations of 211B.04, that's the disclaimer, 211B.12, that's the use of campaign money, and 211B.15, which is the corporate contribution issue. Another reason we're concerned about the disclaimer provision in particular is because it uses some vague language. For example, it says that the disclaimer has to be conspicuous. Our disclaimer provision says that same thing, the independent expenditure provision. And we have had at least one potential plaintiff raise that issue, that word is too vague to be constitutional because it doesn't provide the reader or the speaker, political speaker, with guidance as to what they really have to do to comply. And if it doesn't do that, it may be unconstitutional. And we're working on a rule in our bill that would define what conspicuous is. With regard to the repealers, these are four rules that have been rendered obsolete either by statutory change or board policy. The first one, 4501.0500, that rule says that a fax filing has to be in by the close of business to be timely. And the board recognized that that's probably not, doesn't have a sufficient statutory basis. So a fax filing is timely if we have it by midnight of the day that the report is due. 4503.0200 requires a political fund to have a separate checking account. This is another item where there isn't sufficient statutory basis for it. And in the context of last year's legislation regarding corporate political funds, the board concluded that they would not need to have a separate checking account. Rule 4503.0500 dealt with treating automobile use as a campaign contribution, and in 2010 the statutes were changed to say that automobile use did not have to be considered a contribution. It can be, you can use your volunteers or your own car and not report it as a transaction. And the last, 4503.1700 refers to a 48-hour notice of large pre-election contributions. The statutes change that notice requirement to be a 24-hour notice. And the last one, 4512.0100, relates to gifts of plaques to legislators under the gift prohibition, and that provision was modified substantially so that these definitions are no longer relevant.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr.
Further discussion. Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, one other area that I'd like to point out to members is it changes the date from when the first public subsidy is given to candidates. It had been on September 1st, and it changes it to 1 week before the state primary because of the change in the primary date.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Goldson.
Mr. Chair, if I might just clarify that. Actually, that's a technical change. A public subsidy is actually paid shortly after certification by the canvassing board. This date referred to when the Commissioner of Revenue had to certify to the campaign finance board how much would be paid. And we had a September date in, which, of course, was way after we paid it. And by practice, they certify the week before the primary. So we're just changing that to be consistent with practice.
Is there anyone else cares to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none. Senator Roebling renews her motion that Senate File 1225 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Daley, are you here? Senator Cruz. Cruz, would you like to move the, moves that Senate file 896? Be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans. Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an author's amendment. If members could see what that is, it's fairly technical, just changing, for the most part, the word accounting to accountant. Auditing after industry, auditing private, certified, all that kind of stuff. It's a very simple amendment.
A110357 should be in your packet. According to Carl.
Mr. Chairman, I'll also move that amendment.
Senator Cruz moves the A11 amendment. Further discussion to the A11 amendment. Any discussion? Any questions? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the amendment say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails, the amendment's adopted. Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several people that have traveled quite a few hours to be here today, so I'm going to keep my comments brief and allow them to provide the committee the testimony that is very impactful. This bill, Senate File 896, allows a county to choose a private certified accountant instead of the state auditor to perform the county's annual audit. The state auditor may require additional information from the private CPA as the state auditor deems in the public interest, but must accept the audit unless the state auditor determines that it does not meet recognized auditing industry standards. Just several points. For some of the counties, the OSA's audit is an expensive burden. A county receiving examination by the OSA must pay the total cost and expense of the exam to the state general fund. This means that counties are required to pay what the OSA demands, no matter how many billable hours the OSA accumulates. OSA, the Office of State Auditor. Some counties are therefore generally unable to predict the costs of their annual audits. The experience is much different for a county that has obtained a waiver and has a private CPA to do their audits. Those counties, and there are 28 of them, usually enter into a three-year contract with that CPA firm, and the costs are generally fixed. They're known up front for those 3 years. And the CPA firm absorbs any cost overruns. The second of the 4 points I wanted to make. Private CPAs are cost efficient in performing the county audits. And I'll cite a specific example. Rice County uses a private CPA firm. And the treasurer there estimated the county saves more than $90,000 over a three-year cycle compared with the costs of the state auditor. Such savings will help keep services intact and our property taxes down. Number three, the bill would grant more local control. This bill would allow each county the choice, so it's not a mandate, it's not a must, it's a may. So the choice of whether the state auditor or a private CPA firm performs the audit. There are county auditors who prefer having the state auditor conduct the audit. They'll continue to be allowed to do that. That's still an option under this bill. The fourth and final item, the waiver granting standards are unclear and arbitrary. We've been unable to get straight answers from the state auditor on this matter. As I mentioned before, 28 counties already have this waiver in place. There are 59 counties who don't, and many of those counties would like to have the waiver. They'd like to be allowed to hire a local CPA firm to do that audit. Specifically,
how did the other counties get the waiver?
Primarily back in 2003, 2004, in that time frame, there was an opening. There was an opportunity to, well, there still is, actually. But the auditor at that time was more open to granting the waivers since the current state auditor has been in that position. I don't know for a fact, but I'm fairly certain that there has not been a single waiver granted since 2007. Though many counties have requested, have applied, and been denied. And the reasons are quite vague and uncertain. It's because why? That's what we're trying to at least identify what the specifics are to be granted this waiver as they were in 2003-2004. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn the microphone over to several other folks from counties around the state that either have the waiver and are in favor of it, and will share with the committee why it's been a great thing for them, and several who would like to get the waiver but have been denied.
Thank you, Senator Daly. Who's your first witness? Testify.
Chairman and committee members, my name is Byron Gies, and I'm from Swift County, Auditor. And
welcome to the committee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I guess I would like to testify on behalf of Senator Daly's bill because I strongly feel that it should be an option. Swift County was granted a waiver back in 2006, and I have a letter here that I'd like to present to the committee, but our costs were escalating. In a three-year period, it almost doubled. We dropped $21,000 the first year when we went to a private firm, and we've been with that private firm now 5 years, and we have two more years on that contract with them. But it's not always just money. The state auditor's office, I think, serves a good purpose and are good people, but they don't have the time to train and to correct things as they see them. An example is our 2004 audit from the state auditor's office was completed January of 2006. That's over a year since the transactions happened. The corrective action that was needed took another year to get to. If you don't have an audit on time, your financial people and county commissioners don't have something to fall back on. It's a good financial tool. The private firm has just been very good in training my staff and myself in the new GASB rules, and there's many more coming. And I guess I just would request that you allow counties to have the option, because I've had many counties that have contacted me that have asked, how did you get out of a state audit? And we petitioned back in 2004, and it took us to 2006 to get it. But it's been very, very good for Swift County, and thank you.
Thank you. Senator Reinert.
Mr. Chair, just to quickly clarify, no one would actually be getting out of the audit. It would be allowing local counties to have the opportunity to use a private auditor versus the state auditor.
That's correct. We have yearly audits, and we always will have yearly audits. And we have the state auditor's office review our private audit firm's audit, and they do charge us a very small fee to do that, and I think that's acceptable. But they do have to give their blessing on the end.
Are these audits pretty clear as far as what you're supposed to do in it and what you're looking for? Is that?
Yes, there's standards and guidelines that we have to follow.
Thank you.
So on this point, thank you, Mr. Chair, on this point. So when someone would want to get out of the state audit, does that mean that a state audit might be more stringent than a regular audit?
I mean, no, not at all.
Why would you want to get out of a state audit versus a private audit?
Because the auditors for the state auditor's office are behind up to a year, year and a half. They are much costlier, in our experience anyway, and they don't have the time throughout the year to train as new items come up.
Mr. Goose, what is the time frame with the private auditor?
Okay, and that's in here, but they come in January. They come in December and do a pre-audit, and then they come in January, get their paperwork done, and then we just had ours in the last week in March. We will have a final audit to our county board no later, and it's in our contract, of June 15th. They have been as early as May 1st. And so they're only 4 or 5 months old.
Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I mean, Senator, you've got other testifiers, so but just I think that's a really important point. So you're able, your county board is able to make corrections in the same fiscal year in which the report is received. So that's a, you're closing the books on 09, you get the report in 10, you're able to make those corrections and have them in place for fiscal year 11.
That's correct, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is Mr. Walker here? On the left. Are there further testifiers?
Anyone? Pass that out to you.
You have a page. I can hand this out.
Okay. That. Which who would you like to testify next?
Right now. Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Walker. I'm the Itasca County Auditor Treasurer.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I am here to ask that you give this bill favorable consideration, mainly because it gives counties the ability to go out and get a competitive bid on audit services. And having been in this industry, I've been a CPA for 25 years, both in the public accounting business and now in the governmental side, I can tell you that the standards that will be used by a public accounting firm, private public accounting firm, will be at least as stringent as those that the state auditor uses. So we'll be receiving as good, if not better, service. Just to give you an idea of what Itasca County has experienced over the last several years, our fees to the state auditor in 2005 were $59,836. In 2009, they went up to $100,774. So about a 40% increase. In 2005, there were some standards that were promulgated, specifically Statement of Auditing Standards number 112, that expanded the reporting requirements for auditors in the areas of internal control weaknesses and several other areas that required auditors to spend more work in terms of the compliance areas of audits. So I expected those bills to increase somewhat, but that in no way substantiates a 40% increase in the audit fees. Having no ability to go out and solicit RFPs or competitive bids, I'm stuck with that bill. The other thing I'd like to say is, in terms of these deficiencies, correcting these deficiencies, I think the past auditor mentioned the timeliness of our audits. We're lucky to get our audit report issued by the end of the following year, after the year that's being audited. So we have no way of correcting those deficiencies by the time the next audit is started. And this impacts us significantly because other agencies use our audit results. One in particular is the Department of Justice. They look at the audit results because we receive federal grants. And they're concerned about these deficiencies in internal control weaknesses. And I have to answer for those. And I have to try to correct those. When I go to the state auditor and try to receive help in correcting these, they tell me that it's a conflict of interest for them to provide audit services and consulting services. So I'm stuck with these deficiencies with basically having to go outside and hire a private firm to help in the consulting, or provides consulting services to the county. So I guess what I'm asking is that you allow counties to at least have the ability to go out and bid these services. And quite frankly, if you're concerned about opening up a Pandora's box, there are very few accounting firms that even want to do municipal accounting anymore. It's become an industry of its own, and you have to be an industry expert in order to provide these services. So there's only a handful of firms, private firms, that would actually bid this.
Mr. Walker, when you talk about deficiencies and then correcting them, you're saying that when the state auditor does the audit, that if you ask them how you can fix the deficiency, they can't tell you? Is that what you're saying? Or?
Yes, sir, I have asked that. I have posed that question. I've tried to get help in correcting some of the reported deficiencies, and they tell me it's a conflict of interest for them to provide advice in designing or correcting our accounting systems. That's considered providing consulting services.
Okay. Any questions? Additional testifiers? Senator Nelson.
I have an amendment to offer.
Well, Senator Nelson has an amendment.
That'd be the A1, please.
One amendment. We think it's in your packet. Okay, Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lilly, thank you for, Senator Daley, thank you for bringing this great bill. And I would just like to say what I think is good for counties is also for good for cities of the first class. And I hope you will accept my amendment as a friendly amendment.
I have reviewed, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, committee, I have reviewed the amendment, and it is a friendly amendment.
Further discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair, there is another person who'd like to testify here.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Jake Sieg, and I am the County Auditor Treasurer for Lac-La-Parle County. I am here today to state a position of support for this bill on behalf of the county that I work for. Just a little bit on my background. I have an accounting degree. I have worked in private CPA firms on governmental audit engagements, primarily school districts and cities. And that experience there led me to be appointed as the county auditor treasurer for Lac-La-Parle County in 2007. I have distributed a handout with some more detailed information, but I'm just going to give a brief overview on some of the things that I wanted to touch on. First of all, I want to make sure everyone has a clear understanding of how our county uses our financial statement audits. Our audits provide assurance that our financial information is correct. That information is used to measure the performance of our departments, and it's also used for us in some of the most important decisions that we make, which would include the setting of the county budget and the county levy each year. Bond rating agencies could also use our financial statement information to determine our credit worthiness if our county was interested in using debt financing as a financing tool. And then also the testing that's performed through financial statement audits can also have a nice byproduct is uncovering times when there might be fraud or malfeasance. Audits are not designed specifically to catch those things, but it's one of those things that because they're performing this testing, we might be able to find out about it. Obviously, that information is also important to the state and the federal government, but then also the public. We publish our financial statements, and our financial statements are also available for inspection at all times by the public. And I think that's just a great idea, just because that's one of the ways that our public officials can be held accountable for the decisions that they are making. Now, one thing I wanted to touch on was why we want this option to be able to use private CPA firms. Since I've been auditor treasurer, we have been using the state auditor's office for our audit services. And before I get into those things, I just wanted to clearly state that I do hold the office of the state auditor in very high regard, and I don't want to detract from the hard work that they do. I simply believe that the system as it sits today is just not working for what we need it to do. The primary conflict that's already been touched on is that the Office of the State Auditor on our engagements is billing by the hour. Pretty much however many hours it takes for them to do the engagement, that's what we're going to get billed for. The key difference with the CPA firm is they are going to give us an offer for an engagement of probably 3 years at a time, and they are going to be set amounts. So we will know exactly what it's going to be for those next coming 3 years. And then the other reason that becomes a problem, though, with OSA is because if the audit takes longer, our county has to pay the bill. It becomes our problem if the Office of the State Auditor is not efficient. That burden is shifted when we're using CPA firm audits, because they already have the set engagement fee. It is what it is. And if they're inefficient with their auditing practices, that's their problem, because that's hurting their bottom line. CPA firms are also compelled to bid competitive rates on these engagements, or they're simply not going to get the bid. But with the Office of the State Auditor, they're the only option out there. So they really have no incentive to be competitive from a cost perspective. Another one of the main reasons that I have trouble with the services from the State Auditor's Office is that there is constant staff turnover. New auditors are slower and less efficient than ones that have been around for a little while. I'm not going to say that that's not going to happen in CPA firms, but if a CPA firm has problems with turnover, that's the firm's problem. That's not our problem. And they need to figure out a way to make their engagements remain profitable. Timeliness was another big issue that we've already touched on, and I just wanted to reiterate that. We're constantly making financial decisions, and those decisions, including budgeting happens 5 months after the end of the fiscal year, and so we need to move pretty quickly. We're not getting our audits back from the Office of the State Auditor until 9 to 14 months after the end of the fiscal year. The best counties that I know of, the counties that are most prepared, the first ones to have their engagements start, those counties are getting their audit back after maybe 5 months. And I don't know that CPA firms will be able to get audit results back quicker to us, but I do know from my experience in working on school district and city audits and talking to my former employers that they're almost always able to comply with the state auditor's requirement to have those engagements done within 6 months of the fiscal year. So we know that they're doing it with those engagements. We know that the state auditor's office has a hard time getting it done quickly the way they do things, and I'd just like to see that CPA firms at least have a chance to prove that they can get it done more quickly. Certainty in audit costs was another thing. Like I said, we have an engagement letter and it states a clear fee, and we know what the fee is going to be versus the state auditor's office on an hourly basis. And it can be whatever ends up happening in the audit. We just don't know. And then also, I just wanted to say that I think that periodically changing auditors, I think, is a good practice. Obviously, you don't want to be changing every year because you do start to lose some of those efficiencies. But I think there is a benefit at having a fresh set of eyes look at audits every once in a while. The problem with the state auditor's office is if we have them every single year, we're never going to see that benefit. But if we have several different public accounting firms to choose from for our engagements, we do have that option. And I guess I just want to wrap up and say that I know that my county would benefit from this legislation. I believe every county in the state could benefit from the legislation. CPA firms are every bit as capable as the Office of the State Auditor to complete these engagements. All government audits are regulated by the same governing bodies. They all have to go by the same standards, regardless of whether it's OSA or if it's a public accounting firm. Getting back to the main problem that I see is the system. And the system is that the Office of the State Auditor has a monopoly on county audit engagements, and that's preventing competition and all the good things that come along with competition. That's all I had to say, and I just want to thank you again for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Is there anyone, any questions for the witness? Okay, is there anyone else who cares to testify in favor of Senate File 896? Okay, one more. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Carolyn Holmston. I'm the finance director of Goodhue County, and we are looking for your support on this bill, please. I'm going to issue and sort of reiterate four quick points of what we find as the most important. Cost, as everybody has talked about. State's concerned, counties are concerned. County auditors are really concerned. And there was a rough survey that was sent out about a month or so ago, just trying to get what do people really spend? What have we been spending since 2005? There were 31 responses. 17 of those are performed by the State Auditor's Office, and 14 of those were done by private firms. The difference, the average over those 5 years, the difference was a private firm was $19,000 less per year over those 5 years than what the counties that are paying the State Auditor's Office. 5 years times $19,000, $95,000 plus that could be going to help with other financial issues the counties are facing. Cost is number one. Number two is consistency. School districts and cities, other than those cities of the first class and your amendment you have today, are not required to use the Office of the State Auditor. What makes counties different? School districts can use private firms, cities can use private firms, counties cannot, unless they get the waiver. There have been applications. You heard the discussion earlier today about the denial of those applications and who has and has not. I have not applied for an application at this point. I'm waiting to see what happens with the bill this session. Number three is the flexibility. People have talked about that with timeliness. Both parties have to work together when documents are prepared and reviewed, and depending on the staffing levels of the counties and the State Auditor's Office. And that's becoming a bigger problem all along. As county officers are shrinking and the State Auditor's Office staffing levels, they only have so many that they can get in. And of course, everybody wants their work done in February, March, and April, but it doesn't work that way when you have to work with the State Auditor's Office. They have numerous offices across the state, but every county is pegged with an office or a team out of a certain office, and timeliness is a problem. Nationally, timeliness of audits is becoming a hot topic as well. Users are looking for current information. They want it for bond issues. They want it for a lot of different things. And as you look on, if you Google it online, timeliness of public sector audits is just becoming a hot topic. The last point I have is the quality. If you're concerned about the quality of the audits, every auditor has to follow the generally accepted auditing standards. In the front of an audit, it says those standards are issued by the Comptroller of the United States. Whether you're a public firm or the Office of the State Auditor, they all have the same standards that they must comply with and they must follow on these audits. So if you're looking for quality concerns, I don't feel there's a difference between the two. So we appreciate and we enjoy. We have pleasant people from the auditor staff to work with. It's nothing against the staff themselves. It's the system. We would appreciate the option to say, do we want to use the State Auditor's Office, or would we be interested in using a private sector firm? And so please offer your consideration and support of this bill. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I don't know the auditor's staff, but I know the auditor, and she is a pleasant auditor, and she is here. And
I've worked with Rebecca, too, so I understand that.
I think we are ready for the those who might be against the bill, and if the auditor would like to come up.
Thank you.
But before that, I think Senator Nelson would like to offer an amendment to the bill while we're waiting.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the amendment, I'd like to offer an amendment to the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment was drafted prior to adopting Senator Daley's amendment, so I just want to make that consistent language change, and I'll let our staff read that for you.
Okay, Ms. Stengel.
This would be amending the A1 amendment. On line 6, strike private, and after accountant, insert firm meeting the requirements of section 326A.05. On line 7, strike private. On line 9, strike private, and after accountant, insert firm. On line 11, strike auditing, and after industry, insert auditing. On line 12, strike private, and after accountant, insert firm.
Everyone have that? Okay. Any discussion? Can you explain what your amendment does?
My amendment just takes the language that Senator Daley adopted in the A11 and makes the A1 amendment that we offered in past consistent, using the same language.
It's a technical amendment.
It's a technical amendment.
Any discussion or questions?
Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Daley.
Auditor Otto and I were discussing the importance of making sure that this amendment and the amendment to the amendment is consistent with other state statutes. So maybe council wants to weigh in to make sure that it is consistent with other statutes that are applicable. If it is, then I'm certainly in favor of it.
Ms. Daniel?
I'm sorry, Senator Daley. Are we still talking about the amendment, or are we talking about
the amendment to the amendment?
Yes, the amendment to the amendment makes everything in the bill consistent, so we're using the same phrases, the same everything. So down the line, everybody's on the same page with the same words.
Sounds good to me, Mr. Chair.
Senator Daley. Okay. Any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment to the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Auditor Otto, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Pleasure to be here in front of you today. Senator Vandeveer is somewhat of a neighbor of mine, so I've known him for some time. And our kids went to the same schools, right?
That's correct.
That's correct. Okay, I'm here today to speak in opposition of Senate File 896. We submitted a letter to the committee expressing brief concerns about why we oppose the bill, respectfully, Senator Daley. And there was some testimony today that I found a bit troubling and contained misinformation. And so if people are going to come up to the table and testify about things around timeliness of audits or cost of audits, and it's not accurate, I feel that I must come up and make sure that we're all working from the same page. One of your testifiers, who was a county auditor, said they had to petition for years, and they finally got private in 2006. There wasn't a petition process. The ability for counties to try to work with a private accounting firm happened back in 2003 under a different administration, and it was due to budget cuts, and the auditor thought it was okay to do, although tried to restore those cuts later on before her term ended because she realized the importance of the state auditor auditing counties. Now, since I've been in office, I did not pull all the counties back in. I think it's okay to have a balance between public and private. I feel that we work in as a team with private auditing firms. They call our office every day asking for help. They call and ask our legal people questions on legal compliance issues. And we don't charge them for that, and I don't want to start. But we work in unison. We support their work and their findings, and they appreciate that. They use our materials to tell a county because a state auditor says so. The state auditor's office oversees and audits counties because counties receive a lot of taxpayer dollars that are collected statewide. And so there's a statewide interest in having us conduct those audits. Governmental accounting is not like when you audit private business. It's very, very different. Governmental accounting standards are very complicated. There's not a lot of people in the field. In fact, there's a shortage of people in the field. And so if our function were to go away, there are times when we get calls from entities who can't find a private sector CPA firm that wants to audit them. We're the only one left in town to do it for them. And so it's important to have this function in place. Again, I have not taken back all the counties. We've allowed for flexibility. We let a few more go private who asked us, so we have not been inflexible. But at the end of the day, if a county has requested and been denied, there's a very specific reason. And the reasons are always going to be based on what's in the taxpayer's best interest. That's how it has always worked. I have a professional staff. They have ethics they're guided by, and that's how the process works. I don't want to embarrass any entities here today, because I don't think that that's constructive. But there's reasons why they don't get to go. In terms of timeliness, I've been saving. When I got into office, there was an issue with timeliness, and that there's nothing I can do about what the previous administration did, but I could change it from my point on. So I did a lot of work reaching out to county commissioners because they said, well, you guys are late and you're too expensive. And I said, what have you done to reduce your audit costs? And a lot of them looked at me and they said, what do you mean? And I said, do you know what you can physically do to make sure that you are ready when we walk in the door? Because they didn't always understand that they have to prepare their financial statements and they have to prepare documents that we can actually audit. As an auditor, you have to maintain your independence and there's things you cannot do. So the ones that said, well, they don't have time anymore, we're not really supposed to be doing it for them. And they will have to hire an outside firm or have enough staff and train them. Some counties have made the investment to hire more staff, provide adequate training, and they're doing more of their work. Some counties don't have the ability, some of the smaller counties that came to the table today, minus Goodhue. Now, there's a county that came up to the table. I've saved their audit findings. My staff writes up counties that aren't ready for us when we get there. That was one of the big issues with timeliness. I asked my staff, and they said they're not ready. So when I came in, I had a county tell me who went private. We were never ready when you came in. But when we had a private firm, they said, you have to be ready. And so we've been doing it ever since. And I said, well, that's the way it's working in government, too. We're not waiting anymore. They have to be prepared. And so the counties are doing a much better job of being prepared, because if we have to go and come back and go and come back, of course it adds to cost. It's very inefficient. Since launching this project and making sure county commissioners know what their responsibility is in terms of staffing levels and all hands on deck when our staff gets there, before we get there so they're ready for us, we've been able to reduce billable hours to counties between 2007 and 2009 that we audit by 14%. While there's been increased work required of our office because of stimulus funds and because of new auditing standards that require a lot more work on the local government's end and on our end. So not only should the audit costs have been going up, we've reduced them significantly. The counties are doing a really good job in responding. We write them up if they're not ready, and I have to tell you today, Itasca County has been written up. So when you want to talk about timeliness, we need to be factual. They have to be ready for us when we walk in the door, or they don't get their audit in time, and they go to the back of the line. And so there's responsibility on both ends. My staff has done a phenomenal job of working with the counties and making sure they know what they need to do. The counties were much more timely this year, so this last audit cycle, we were very proud of them. And now some people say, well, the private sector, they get to you January, February, March. I heard that. No, not necessarily. There was a late audit this year from a private sector firm. They weren't on time, and they don't all get done in January, February, or March. It depends on the firm. It depends on when the local government engages with them and their staffing. Finally, the cost question. There has not been a study done on audit costs between our audits versus the private sector audits. So if someone says there has been a study, I'd like to see that study. Some counties will tell you what they spent in a calendar year on an auditor versus what the actual audit cost was for that particular year. Can be two very different numbers. One of the counties come up and said, oh, our audit cost went from this year to this year, and the numbers are wrong. I'm not naming the county. So I would tell you that our office is there for the taxpayer's best interest at the end of the day always. And there is a, right now there's a process for counties to work with private firms. And I have not heard a lot of entities being upset. Some of the ones that are smaller and have less staff think that it may be a panacea or might have had some bumps along the road during an audit, and it's kind of like wanting to go live with the other parent when the parents are divorced. We're oversight. We're not necessarily their friends, although my staff is wonderful and very professional. But an audit is an audit is an audit. And the reason why government gets audited is because it's taxpayer dollars, and this is part of accountability and transparency in handling taxpayer dollars is a much higher level of accountability and transparency. I think, Mr. Chair, I have to leave in about 1 minute here. I wanted to make sure I came in and provided some clarification. And if you would like me at any other time to get back to you on anything, and Senator Daley, we work with the counties. We work with the private firms. They do call us and they need us. We're an important function. And I think the system that we currently have works. And I do want to point out this gives you zero savings to the state's general fund. Because when we get an appropriation to conduct an audit, we put it all back. And so this is not a cost-saving measure for the state. This is, and I will tell you, one county made the mistake of telling me, oh, your office is much pickier. You care about legal compliance, and some of these firms don't. And my answer to that is, wrong thing to tell me. There has been a private sector firm who audited a county who was required to reissue the audit because it was not correct. So there have been problems with private sector audits before, and so they're not always perfect, although, again, we work in concert with these firms, and for the most part, they do a fine job. But I believe it'd be the wrong direction to go to allow it to go all private.
Thank you, Auditor. Senator Kalish, you had a question.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Auditor Otto, one of the things that keeps coming up in all of this is it seems like there's a problem getting timely stuff there, and I'm just wondering if your staffing is at full force or if you've reduced staffing that's made it more difficult to comply or to service these counties.
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kalish, that's a good question. Part of the timeliness issue is the counties. So as lawmakers, if you cut the counties and they have to continue to reduce staff, it's very difficult for them because they're required to do more work than ever, so they really need more. But the financial situation we find ourselves in is difficult for them to do that. So they may be behind in getting their information prepared, or it may be more difficult for them to prepare it. And then us. Now, have I come and asked for lots more money? I've asked to keep the staff that I have. Can you use more staff? I bet you most people would say, sure, we could use more. But what we do is we're pretty conservative in our nature in the office, and I have worked in restructuring my office. We function differently. We're using technology much more. There's things we can do to make ourselves more efficient and more productive, cutting down on windshield time, utilizing technology wherever we can. So we've been doing everything we can. So I would say that staffing affects the audit process for both the county and our office, but I did not ask to increase my complement at this time. But as auditing standards change or new monies like stimulus funds that required a lot more work to be done for us, all those things can impact the amount of time it takes to get an audit, first prepare for an audit, and then for us to do the work. But the timeliness issue wasn't a real big issue this year. It was much, much better on our end and on their end as well.
Thank you. Okay.
Additional questions? Further comments, Auditor?
Mr. Chair, thank you so much for allowing me to testify today, and thank you, Senator Daley.
Thank you. Thank you for coming
And I will leave now.
At your pleasure. Thank you. Okay, further discussion to Senate File 896.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In response to some of the comments that the auditor just made, may I respond?
Senator Daley, you may.
With respect to government accounting being so complicated that maybe the assumption was only the state auditor can do it, our local CPA firms have very similar kind of training, the same kind of training. They're every bit as capable. They have continuing education requirements. You know, maybe I'll make an analogy between doctors. You know, you've got a pediatrician and a heart surgeon, and you don't expect the pediatrician to go in and do the heart surgery. CPA firms specialize in many different things. They're tax specialists, they're audit specialists, they're trusted business advisors. And the firms that take up this government accounting kind of audit, they're specialists in it. They are experts in it. They know what they're doing. They're every bit as capable as anyone in the state auditor's office. Some would say even more qualified because the turnover is so great at the state auditor's office that it's new folks that are coming in all the time, and the counties have to train them how to do the job or where to find certain things in their own files. With the private CPA firms, they're not having to do that, especially when the same folks are on that audit year after year after year. With respect to the certainty of costs, with the contracts that the counties are doing, they get that certainty. That was mentioned previously. I just want to emphasize the importance to counties, the commissioners, the boards, when they're doing their budgeting, it's important to know what their costs are. And I have a spreadsheet where we did receive a lot of information on what the counties are paying. And one year in a particular county, they paid $72,000. The next year, $73,000. That's pretty consistent. It's not the exact same amount as you'd get with a CPA firm, but it's close. The following year, they paid $124,000. So it went from $73,000 to $124,000, almost twice as much. The next year, in a very good way, it dropped to 65. But the following year, it went back up to $128,000. So it's all over the board, and it's hard for counties to plan, commissioners to do their budgets when the numbers are bouncing up and down and up and down. Finally, blaming the counties for the cost overruns. Counties have an incentive to keep their costs down. So they're going to be as ready as they possibly can, whether it's a CPA firm, private CPA firm, or the state to come in. In fact, they're less incented to be ready for the private CPA firm than they are the state auditor, because the state auditor is going to bill them per hour. The local CPA firm has a set price. So no matter how long it takes, that's what the price is going to be. So there's less of an incentive to get ready for the private CPA firm than the state auditor. Not as the state auditor would have led you to believe that they're not ready, so it's taken longer. It's counterintuitive. That's just my personal view on that particular subject. I just want to thank the folks that came to testify. They drove a long way, and I don't question their integrity. I believe what they had to say, and I trust them. They have a vested interest in this. They've got skin in the game, and this is not a mandate. This is a may. This allows counties who want to do this. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Senator Daley. Senator McGuire.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Daley. Could you just give us the name of the county? I would do some checking, because now we've heard two different things. Either counties are ready or they're not.
I will do that privately with you.
So if you could let me
absolutely
ask the name of that would be great. Because you gave us some
absolutely
pretty interesting
I'll give you the entire spreadsheet.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Daley, the last line of your bill says that a county audited by a private public accountant cannot be required to pay the state general fund any cost for state auditor services. And I was just thinking, if they do conduct a private audit, doesn't the state auditor's office still have a role to play in reviewing that private audit?
Yes, they do.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Daley, how do you propose that the state auditor pays for that oversight?
Senator Daley.
As the bill was originally drafted, I would say that is something. I'll just say that's something I'm open to review. I'm open to modification as it travels. I'm not sure where the next committee is.
State government ops.
I'd be happy to work with you to implement the right kind of language, because if they've got an additional function they need to do, it's only reasonable that they're compensated for that. And you know, maybe it's 1% of the audit, somewhere in that range, something like that, if it becomes necessary.
Senator Sieben, did you have?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd just say hopefully you'll work with the auditor, too, if this legislation is going to move
absolutely
forward. Absolutely.
Yes.
She'll probably
yes
have some ideas.
Yes.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Senator Daley, I think your first testifier said that they were doing private audits or audits by a private firm, and they paid a very modest fee when they submitted it for review. And so there must be some sort of formula already in place that would be able to be used. But I was puzzling about the language that said that nothing could be charged, and somebody said something was charged. And so there must be some formula that you might be able to use.
I'm not familiar with
Senator
the specific
Daley
formula that's in place. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the fiscal note, it said $26,000, and I don't know exactly what those assumptions were. I haven't had a chance to talk to the person who created that fiscal note and what the assumptions were that they used, but there are some reasonable costs that they may incur that we should include.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none. Senator Cruz renews his motion that Senate File 896 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans. As amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
Motion prevails. Passed and be referred to State Government, Innovation, and Veterans.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You,
thank you, members.
Now, I have two announcements before we adjourn. One, we'll reconvene at 6:15 in room 107. That's across the hall. And Senate File 1079, Senator Thompson's bill, is pulled from the agenda for today. We won't be and will not be heard this evening if you are waiting to testify on that bill. So with that, we will recess until 6:15 in room 107.